Okay, so great pleasure to have Peter Mintz with us today from the Heisenberg Institute in Munich, talking about Bogomolny equations for the Einstein-Daniels Dilithium system.
Okay, thank you. Well, I have written some relevant literature, in particular this first paper which appeared this year is more or less dealing with the content of this talk. Now this talk will be essentially the story of a particular solution of the Einstein-Young-Mills Dilithium equations, which then turns out to fulfill a system of Bogomolny type equations. And so we'll try to tell you the story of this solution, and on the way then to mention some other related things of interest. The story starts with this paper of Bartnik and McKinnon in 88, which was a very short note, where they produced some numerical evidence for the existence of soliton type solutions of the Einstein-Young-Mills equations. Now, this soliton type means that these are solutions which are well localized, they are static, actually they are spherically symmetric and asymptotically flat and have finite mass. Well localized means that they are essentially confined to a very small radius, because the Planck length is the only length scale in this system, because the classical Young-Mills equations have no scale. And so this object has a mass of the order of the Planck mass and is localized to the order of 1 over the Planck mass. So it's a very small and very heavy object. And as I said, it's static, spherically symmetric, and it's and what is more remarkable, it is absolutely smooth, so it has no singularity. And this, in a way, came to me as a kind of surprise, because there is no such thing in the, say, for the Einstein-Maxwell system with a billion vectors. And in fact, at this time, just before, I was involved in a study of solutions, stationary solutions of generalizations of the Einstein-Maxwell equations, which were of the Kaluza-Klein type, and in particular including all the known supergravity theories with a billion vectors. This was a paper with Peter Breitenlohner and Gary Gibbons. And there we showed, actually, well, there is a theorem for the Einstein-Maxwell theory due to Lichnerowitz, which says that there are no solitons in this Einstein-Maxwell theory, which means there are no stationary, localized, smooth solutions. Now, the reason why you don't find any smooth, localized, stationary solutions is that if you look at the Einstein-Maxwell equations, or in particular in this more general class of supergravity models with a billion vectors, if you look at stationary solutions, you can, in fact, formulate the theory as a three-dimensional theory, because nothing depends on time. And then you find that these solutions are kind of harmonic maps. And you know that for harmonic functions, that they have to have some singularities in order to be non-trivial. And this is, in a way, very much related to this standard fact that harmonic functions have to have singularities. And so, in a way, I was quite surprised to see these things emerge, smooth solutions emerge in the Einstein-Young-Mills system. And first, I was a bit skeptical, but then I got convinced that, in fact, we have these kind of solutions. And let me just explain a little bit how that solution came out. So you're studying spherically symmetric fields, and actually the ansatz is very much like the ansatz, the Toft ansatz for the magnetic monopole. So you put the electric component, and the gauge group is just SU2, the simplest non-abelian. And so you put the electric component to zero, and for the spatial components, you have kind of a magnetic type ansatz, which has this form, well-known form, with some function W of R, which characterizes the Young-Mills potential. So this is exactly the answer that you use for the Toff-Polyakov monopole. And then, well, and you have some answers for the spherically symmetric metric, and you plug this into the Einstein-Young-Mills equations, and then integrate them numerically and look for smooth solutions. And what you find is that what Bartnik and McKinnon found, that there are solutions which look like that, where W actually has to start with 1 or minus 1 at the origin in order to be smooth, and then it just goes from 1, plus 1 to minus 1. Actually, there are more solutions. So this is a solution where W is 1, 0, so let's call this the n equal 1. They found that there are actually others which look like that, which come back to n equal, to W equal 1, and so on. And so there are solutions for n equals 0, which is just W identically equal to 1, which in fact is nothing but Schwarzschild or Minkowski. And then you have solutions for any number of zeros, and even as a limiting solution with infinitely many zeros. So this is what Bartnik and McKinnon found. Now, these solutions, also they use these Toft ansatz, they have no magnetic charge. And in fact, if you look at the corresponding function, Young-Mills potential W for the monopole, then you find that actually it goes from 1 to 0 at infinity. And if you have this asymptotic behavior, where W squared goes to 1 at infinity, you have no charge, which means that the field strength decays faster than 1 over R squared, so there is no global charge to this solution. Einstein-Young-Mills. With this particular answer, it's for the Young-Mills potential.
What's the stress energy
for the Young-Mills field? It's like Einstein-Maxwell, very similar. Just E squared, or E components made bilinear in the electric field string, the magnetic field string. And this is purely magnetic here, so the electric component is zero. Now, in fact, so this is the monopole, the behavior of W for the magnetic monopole, and this in flat space you find when you couple the Young-Mills field to a triplet Higgs, so you need a Higgs field in order to have the monopole. In fact, one reason for that is that the Young-Mills field in flat space, as I said, has no scale, so it cannot have non-trivial localized solutions of finite energy. And somehow it's the Higgs field that gives us a scale. There is another type of solution which has actually this kind of shape, and that is called the sphaleron. So there is a thing called the sphaleron, and this you get with a Higgs doublet field. So in flat space. So, and the name sphaleron should indicate that this is actually an unstable solution. Now, in order to, and in fact, this sphaleron has exactly this kind of shape. But there is nothing like this, no, so to say, radial excitations. There's only this basic solution, which you find, by numerically solving the coupled Young-Mills-Higgs equations with the corresponding ansatz. Now, in order to see the instability, you have to know that actually there is a more general ansatz. The most general spherically symmetric ansatz for Young-Mills field involves actually 4 arbitrary functions. The reason is that, you see, for a gauge field, spherical symmetry means gauge rotational invariance up to gauge transformations. So you have to embed the rotation group into the gauge group, and therefore, if you then compensate rotations by gauge transformations, you lose part of your gauge invariance. And so essentially what happens is that the gauge group SU2 is reduced to a gauge group U1 by this requirement of spherical symmetry. And it turns out that you can formulate this theory then on a manifold, which is in the spherically symmetric case, which corresponds to a product with two spheres and some non-trivial two-dimensional space parameterized by T and R. And what you find is a U1 gauge theory with two component abelian potential and a complex scalar. And it is the complex, the imaginary part of W, which gets excited in order to get this instability. So you have to excite the imaginary part. And actually, the flat sphaleron turns out to be stable if you stay within this minimal ansatz. So if you don't excite the imaginary part, then this is a minimum of the energy and is stable. Now, this is not so turned out for this Bartnik-McKinnon. Namely, it was found that this nice solution, soliton-type solution of Bartnik-McKinnon, actually isn't like a soliton. It's more like a sphaleron, namely in the sense that it is also unstable. Now, when I looked at this first, I remember I was a bit confused. Namely, I remembered this argument which you give that if you have a gravitational collapse, you end up with the Kerr solution because the gravitational field radiates away everything it can radiate. So it cannot radiate, so to say, the monopole and the dipole. Now, I thought I have this spherically symmetric solution, and it's made up from a Young-Mills field, which has spin 1, gravitational field, which has spin 2. It cannot radiate an S wave, so it must be stable. Now, it turns out that this argument is just wrong. The whole thing can, in fact, collapse or dilute to Minkowski space by some kind of a shock front, which is spherically symmetric. And one reason for that, that is this possible, is that the Birkhoff theorem is not valid for Einstein-Young-Mills. So this allows spherically symmetric time-dependent solutions, which you get when you study the stability of these solutions. So after that, so the interpretation of these solutions was that they are some kind of gravitational sphalerons. And in fact, as I said, the Young-Mills field itself, because it has no scale, cannot build any localized finite energy, static localized finite energy object. But you need another field to give it a scale. Or you could also say that the purely magnetic Young-Mills interaction is repulsive, and it needs some attractive force to bind it to something localized, like in the case of the monopole, you have the Higgs triplet, or you hear for the flat sphaleron, you have the Higgs doublet. And so the gravitational field, in a way, you could say, binds this thing together, but in this case, in an unstable fashion. Now, in order to test this idea, I thought maybe I should look at the Young-Mills-Dilaton equations, which is simpler. I replace the gravitational field by a dilaton. And if this idea is true, there should be also such a solution just with a scalar dilaton coupled to the Young-Mills field. And this is I did this with a postdoc from Georgia, with George Lafrelashvili, and we found, in fact, there's the same type of solutions also if you couple the Young-Mills field just to a dilaton. So the action then is very simple. You just have the term for the dilaton, and then you have some coupling to the Young-Mills field. So something like E2 gamma phi raised F squared.
When you said George is from Georgia,
yeah,
you mean in Russia, right?
Yeah. Okay. I didn't understand that.
Well, there's a Georgia in the United States too.
Oh. It's not in Russia. Georgia is an independent state, so they don't like to be called Russians. Therefore, I was confused that they said it's in Russia. No. The original Georgia at the Black Sea.
While we're taking a little break here, I wonder if I've got the thing right. Could you take the pure Young-Mills sectors, and there's no stable solutions?
There is no time-independent localized solution with finite energy. There are solutions with infinite energy, actually, which are time independent. Some kind of oscillating thing. I could explain it, but it would take some time.
How do you get infinite energy in gravity?
Yeah. For instance. Here it says finite mass. But this I was talking, this was about flat space. So
then we add in scalar fields. And now I'm just looking for summary, right? And now are there any stable solutions of finite energy there?
You mean in flat space or
no, in with gravity.
Gravity and scalars?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are. Okay.
There are these boson star solutions. If you have a charged scalar and couple it to the gravitational field, you can have these boson stars, which were studied by T.D. Lee and other people. Or if you have two scalars, there are solutions with two different scalars. Okay, so now but I want to come to my solution. So we studied this. And found there are, again, these Bartnik McKinnon-type solutions for this, in a way establishing this idea that these are gravitationally bound sphalerons. But since we had our programs and running, so we said, why not study the coupled thing? So Einstein-Young-Mills-Dilaton. So we started off to do Einstein-Young-Mills-Dilaton. And in particular, there is one case. You see, this gamma is an arbitrary parameter which describes the strength of the dilaton coupling. It's like the Newton constant. So this is a kind of coupling constant. And if you take gamma equal to 2, then there is this thing combined with gravity corresponds to a theory which is n equal 4 supergravity model. So you can embed this thing into this n equal 4 supergravity, which may be related to string theory. So there was some interest to study this particular case. Now, and there we found a surprise. Namely, when you try to get this solution, the usual method we used was to start off at the origin and integrate the field equations outward to infinity and try to find the solution which is globally regular. Now, in order to do that, you have to take solutions which are regular at the origin. It turns out these solutions have the following form. W is 1 minus some coefficient times r squared plus higher order terms, which are all determined in terms of this b. And in fact, the gravitational field is also has no other free parameter. So this is the only parameter you can fine-tune in order to make the solution globally regular. But in general, when you do this, for instance, for Bartnik McKinnon, you find some weird numbers for b, like the n equal 1 solution is b, something like 4, 5, and so on. However, in this model, this gamma equal 2, we found b equal is 1/6, up to 12 digits. Actually, it was George who found this first. He told me that I didn't believe, and then convinced ourselves. And there are some more regularities in this solution, which gave us somehow the conviction that maybe you can find the exact solution in this case.
What number of digits did you finally
get? No, we immediately get 10 digits or so. This was the precision of our code. So, and when you have 10 digits, you are content. Okay, and there were some other irregularities which we later found with this solution. So, anyway, we said there must be an exact solution. And in fact, this is in a way related to the question of the monopole, because also for the monopole, there is a particular case, the so-called PPS monopole, and there B is also 1/6. So this looks like that. So it doesn't look like that. It looks like that. But it's also B equal 1/6. So I said maybe, and in fact, this monopole, as I will discuss in a minute, the solution is related to so-called Bogomolny equations. So I thought maybe there is also some Bogomolny equations, in particular since they have to do something with supersymmetry. And a point I will come to in a minute. And so I was looking for candidates for Bogomolny equations. And I didn't come up with anything reasonable until now. So this, all this was in 93, and I mean, you look for an exact solution for a while, it's kind of a sport. And then eventually you say, if you don't find it, you say, okay, forget it. But in your heart, you are not satisfied with such a situation. You always think, damn, there must be a way to get this solution. And so from time to time I look onto this. Now,
so the solutions you found here all have magnetic charges?
No, this is uncharged. This is, has no magnetic charge. It has no Higgs field. There is no Higgs field. There is no notion of magnetic charge here, you see. There's only a Niels field, and there's no invariant definition of the magnetic charge here. So these are there's some kind of glue balls or whatever, gravitationally bound, but they are unstable. That's rather. Now, so this, so to say, ends the introduction about this solution, and now I will come to the Bogomolny equations, which this thing eventually solves. And for that, I have some transparencies. So now, let me start off, since I guess not everybody here is familiar with Bogomolny equations. Also, it's now a very popular subject. To just shortly discuss this equations for the monopoles. So as I said, for the monopole we start off with the gauge field and the Higgs triplet field, and the action is the Engels part and the Higgs part with the self-coupling. Now again we look for just static and purely magnetic configurations which have no electric component, and then it turns out there is an inequality for the energy of such configurations, which is called the Bogomolny bound. You get it like that if you plug in the ansatz, the Toft ansatz, just the magnetic ansatz, no particular spherically symmetric form, just general Young-Wills static Young-Wills field. Then you find there is a contribution which is B squared, which comes from this. There is the d phi squared, and then there's the potential term. Now, from these two, you can make a complete square with some remaining term. And now you can estimate this by putting this to zero and this to zero. And you find this expression, which, in fact, you can pull out the derivative because of the Bianchi identity for the magnetic part. And you find that this is a surface integral and it's just a multiple of the magnetic charge of the solution. So you get a bound of the energy in terms of the magnetic charge. And you find that this inequality becomes an equality if first this lambda vanishes, this self-coupling term, and if the magnetic field is equal plus or minus to the covariant derivative of the Higgs field. Now this is a system of first order equations for these fields which are called Bogomolny equations. Now, there is a certain interpretation or relation of these equations to the self-duality equations of Young-Wills. Namely, you can start off, instead of, this was a Minkowskian four-dimensional theory of a Young-Wills field and a Higgs field. Instead, you start off with the Euclidean Young-Wills theory without a Higgs field in four dimensions, and put the zero component of the electric component in Young-Wills equal to, you call that phi, and in fact it turns out if you look for x4 independent configurations, so like time independent configurations, then the electric field of this field strength of this Young-Wills field is just the covariant derivative of this fourth component. And the self-duality equations for this Euclidean Young-Wills theory for x4 independent configurations is just this equation, which says that E is equal to plus or minus B. So, and as is well known, the self-duality equations imply the field equations. So this Bogomolny equation implies the second order field equations. And in fact, the energy is nothing but the reduced Euclidean action, and therefore this is also the since solutions are minimum of the energy, they are minimum of the action, and therefore solve the field equations. Now, in the case of if you now look for the spherically symmetric solutions of the Bogomolnik equations, it turns out that you can find an exact solution with the so-called PPS monopole. So now we make this Toft ansatz and some kind of spherically symmetric ansatz for the Higgs field, and then you find this first order system for these two functions W and H, and you can solve them in terms of Sinch and Kosh and so on. So that is a well-known solution, and it looks like that, that W smoothly goes from 1 to 0, decays exponentially, where V is now the scale of the solution, which is related to the mass of the Mengmuth field, and the Higgs field just raises from 0 to some asymptotic value. So that is the solution, which, and in fact, if you expand this, you get this 1/6, if you put V equal to 1. So that is this PPS solution. Now there is a relation to supersymmetry, and that was, I think, first observed by Olive and Witten, and there were some other people looking at that. And that comes about in the following way, and this is also an old subject, so this is all 20 years old. As I said, you can interpret the BPS solution as a solution of the Euclidean Young-Mills theory, identifying the Higgs field is the fourth component of the vector potential. Now, if you want to embed this into a supersymmetric Young-Mills theory, turns out that there is a problem, because there is no n equal 1 supersymmetric Young-Mills theory in four Euclidean dimensions because of the lack of Majorana spinors, which you need for supersymmetry. However, there is a so-called n equal 2 theory, where you have two supercharges, two types of supercharges, and that also leads to a second Higgs field. And the fermions turn out to be a doublet of SO2 Majorana spinors. So there's something like SO2 Majorana spinors. There are no Majorana spinors without an extra degree of freedom. This is discrete SO2 index. And the variation of this fermion, this fermionic partner of the bosons, is written down here. So this is the supersymmetry variation. Now, it turns out that under certain conditions, the solution maintains some of the supersymmetry, which means some of these super variations vanish. So the fermion fields are put to zero for these solutions. And then you ask, is this consistent with supersymmetry? And so some of these variations can vanish. And the reason for that is that you have, in this n equal 2 theory, you have a central charge in the supersymmetry algebra. So if you write down the algebra of supersymmetry charges for this theory, for static solutions, you find that there are actually two terms. There is a term proportional to the mass, and there is another term, which is the so-called central charge, which in this case turns out to be proportional to the magnetic charge of the solution. Now, from this, in the usual way, actually you find immediately the Bogomolnik inequality, namely that the mass has to be bigger or equal to the magnetic charge. Now, I have put this parameter V equal to 1. This is an argument very similar as was used by Witten for the positive mass theorem. This is just using the positivity of certain components of the left-hand side, naively. Now, again, it turns out that equality in this inequality you get if the Bogomolnik equations are fulfilled, as we know, and this implies, in fact, that one half of these Qs have to vanish. And the condition for that is that these spinor parameters are obey a certain chirality condition. And so if this chirality condition is fulfilled and the bosonic fields obey the Bogomolnik equation, one half of the super variations vanish and you get, so to say, a solution which maintains half of the supersymmetries of this n equal 2 super Young-Mills theory. So that is the relevant property here, that you maintain the solution maintains partial part of the supersymmetry. In fact, this can be generalized to dions by also introducing electric charge, but that is not important in the moment for us. So that is the situation with these monopoles in flat space. Now let's come back to gravity and look for Bogomolny equations in Emil's coupled to gravity. Now there is a well-known case, and that is with abelian vectors. So the simplest such theory is Einstein-Maxwell again. And in fact, it turns out that there are Bogomolny-type solutions, and this is the extremal Reisner-Nordström solution and its partners, the Papa-Petru-Majumdar solutions. And the relevant supersymmetric theory in which you can embed this solution is the n equal 2 supergravity theory with the abelian vector. And I think this was first observed by Gibbons and Hall, who also derived this inequality, Bogomolny inequality, for the mass of black holes, charged black holes, in this theory. Now again, there is now a supersymmetric partner of the bosonic fields, and that is a Rarita-Schwinger field, and its variation looks like the generalized covariant derivative of a spinor parameter. And it turns out that the corresponding Bogomolny equations, very similar to the case of the monopole, can be obtained by requiring that there are solutions to the equations that this covariant derivative of epsilon is equal to zero. Such objects are called killing spinors, and it was shown by Todd that actually the extremal Reisner-Nordström solution and certain generalizations, as I said, are exactly related to the existence of such killing spinors. Now, the solution is well known in this case, and its suitable units, the metric is just has this simple form. And interesting enough, this can also be solved exactly with a cosmological constant. Now there is a generalization of this to again n equal 4 supergravity, which is also the theory which I mentioned before, however with abelian vectors. And there, in addition to the Maxwell field, you also have a dilaton. You have other fields, but this you put to zero. And in fact, it turns out that again you can write down such equations, and you get a rather simple form of the solution if you introduce a suitable radial variable, which is the usual radial rescaled with the dilaton field. So that is the abelian part. But now the question, there is an interesting question. Is there a solution with a non-vanishing cosmological constant? I tried, and I searched the literature, and I couldn't find it. And maybe you know.
Well, let's see. We should talk about it afterwards. I vaguely remember something.
I tried to get the correspond. You see, there is the exact solution of this this extremal solution here with a cosmological constant in the case without the dilaton. Then there is the solution with the dilaton but without cosmological constant. So you would expect there should also be, and in particular since these functions look similar, there should be a solution with non-vanishing cosmological constant, but I couldn't find it. And whatever I do, I come up with a system of differential equations which I cannot solve exactly. I mean, clearly there is the solution, but you cannot write down it in closed form. So this is...
The solution you wrote down here for the abelian one, is that with gamma equal to 2?
That's the gamma equal to 2, yes. That is the abelian solution that I think first was studied by Gibbons and Maeda, and also you were involved in some study of these solutions. Actually, a similar solution was found somewhat earlier by a student of mine, Dobiasz. He looked at the Kaluza-Klein theory, where gamma is equal to square root of 3.
Right.
And there you can, I mean, you can solve this, you can find a solution for any gamma.
You can find a solution for any gamma.
Yeah, and we got the one for square root of 3. And the property is always that the area of the horizon is 0. So it's because the horizon turns out to be at capital R equal 1. And if you look at this radial function, R, it vanishes. So the surface area, so it's a bit singular as a black hole, I would say, apart from the fact that it is extremal. Okay, that much for the abelian. And now I come to the non-abelian. Now, it was observed already in 1992, 1993 by Curie and some other people that you could embed the DPS monopole in, again, supergravity theory. In this case, n equal 4 supergravity. However, you need a supergravity multiplet plus Young-Mills multiplet in addition, which, I mean, if you start off to get this n equal 4 theory from the n equal 1 theory in 10 dimensions, already in 10 dimensions, you need a Young-Mills field. And this is a kind of field theory related to heterotic strings instead of, say, type 2 strings, which you have for this other kind of theory for the abelian case. And in fact, the monopole is what people call a 5-plane now. It's quite interesting that you can, in fact, embed the flat monopole into a theory which has gravity into it. Now, the reason for that is that the self-duality equations are conformally invariant. And it turns out that the metric which you get for this embedding is conformally flat. So the self-duality equations don't change. However, there is something that's a bit strange, namely, if you look at the action, you find that there is this term of the dilaton coupling to the Young-Mills field strings. So the field equations are changed. Now, I told you that the flat field equations are a consequence of self-duality. So then you would expect that you get somehow the field equations without the dilaton. And on the other hand, the two field equations involve the dilaton now, the field equations for the Young-Mills. Now, the solution to this is that there are extra terms in the action, some Chern-Simons terms, which couple the axion to the Young-Mills potential. And indeed, for this particular solution, this axion field is related again to the dilaton, and therefore it comes out all very well. And you find that there's, in fact, the DPS monopole can be made a solution of this coupled Einstein-Young-Mills system, which is embedded into this n equal 4 supergravity super Young-Mills theory. And the expression for the dilaton and for the axion are written down here in terms of the DPS monopole fields W and H. And again, turns out that you maintain half of the supersymmetries due to the vanishing of some of the variations of the fermionic partners. Now, I first thought maybe our solution, which we're looking for, can be related to this, with the BPS monopole, in particular since there's this coefficient 1/6, which is the same. But it turned out that there is no relation whatsoever. And the reason is that in one case, this function W decays exponentially to 0 at infinity. In the other case, it goes like a power to minus 1. So there's just no way to get this. And in fact, now recently it turned out that there's another way of getting the solution as a Bogomolny one. And that, now I come to the recent literature, namely there's this paper by Chamsuddin and Forkov. Forkov was involved in some of these Spartnik-McKinnon type studies staying in Zurich with Straumann, and he knew about our exact solution. And then he came up with a remarkable embedding of the monopole into a theory which has no Higgs field. So it's quite interesting. So I hope I don't confuse you too much with all these various supersymmetric theories and solutions, but it's again the PPS monopole which is involved. And in fact, this as Chamsuddin and Foucault showed, the PPS monopole can be made a solution of a so-called n equal 4 gauged SC2 plus SC2 supergravity theory, which is a theory written down already in 78 by Friedman and Schwartz. And apart from other fields like axions and so on, this has an action which is just the standard Einstein-Dilaton-Yang-Mills action. But due to this gauging, well, I have to maybe say a word what this gauging means. This n equal 4 theory, the standard n equal 4 supergravity theory, has a billion vectors. Now, it turns out that you can, by changing the action somewhat, turn these into non-abelian gauge fields, which correspond to the, so there are two triplets of gauge fields corresponding to two SU2 groups, and you can make a non-abelian theory out of it. But the price is you have to add a potential term for the dilaton, which looks like a cosmological constant modified with the power of the dilaton. Now, if you do that, you can again write down supersymmetry variations, and where they have now a rather complicated killing spinor condition with a covariant derivative involving the Lorentz connection and the Yang-Mills connection, and some extra term which is absent in the non-gauged version of the theory. So there is this extra piece here involving the gauge coupling constants, which are, well, okay, I will come back to me. But there is no Higgs field, and nevertheless you can...
Do you know if this theory is just what you get if you start with a 10-dimensional...
I will come to that. Come to that. You are anticipating my next transparency, namely, just right on the head of the next transparency, that you can get that by a kind of dimensional reduction. Now, in fact, from 10 dimensions, n equal 1 theory, however, on a product of two 3 spheres as an internal space, which is just the group manifold of these SU2 cross SU2. Now, this, what is called dimensional reduction, is a bit misleading. Usually, when we do dimensional reduction, say for in the abelian case, where you compactify on a flat manifold, then what you start with is the assumption that you have, say, a higher dimensional theory, and now you look for the most general solutions of the solutions which have a symmetry, like the independent of 6 of the internal coordinates, or have this kind of isometry which is related to some internal flat space. Now, this is not what is meant here. What is meant here is a parametrization of the 10-dimensional theory in terms of 4-dimensional fields, such that if you solve the corresponding 4-dimensional field equations, automatically solves the 10-dimensional theory. So it's not the most general such theory. Now, for instance, these things have been also achieved for this famous n equal 8 supergravity compactified on the 7th sphere. Again, there it's not known what is the so the action for active action in 4 dimensions for the most general solutions, but you have an embedding. You have embeddings of the 4-dimensional solutions into the 10-dimensional. And this is what can be done here. Now, due to this potential term, there is no supersymmetric vacuum here. Because, you see, Minkowski space does not solve the equations. And also, the ADS does not solve the equations, because the dilaton field equation does not allow the dilaton to become trivial at infinity. So there is no supersymmetric vacuum here. However, it turns out that you can maintain one quarter of the supersymmetries by a particular embedding of the PPS monopole. And that's quite interesting, and this was observed by Chamsuddin and Folkov. So what they do is they put one of these gauge couplings to zero, which means one of the SU2s becomes actually a U1 cube, so it's trivial, it's flat. You make you replace one of these 3 spheres by flat space of torus and keep only one of the gauge fields. So you put one of the one sort of gauge fields to zero, and you keep only the other type, and then you require again variation, vanishing variation of this Aurita-Schwinger field, which again has this form, as I have written down, of a covariant derivative of a spinor, which is a kind of killing spinor condition. Now it comes along story, which I do not show here. You have to make a spherically symmetric ansatz for this Aurita, for this spinor, and so on, and then you get a huge set of equations, and you put the determinant of this linear system to zero and so on, and then when you have worked it through, you find that essentially this is what you get out as equations for the spherically symmetric ansatz in terms of the bosonic components. Now, for the metric is this two-dimensional metric plus the trivial piece of the two spheres. So you make this conformally flat ansatz for this two metric, and you introduce a new variable, which is the derivative. You use a radial coordinate, which is different from the radius of the sphere. So this is a kind of isotropic or whatever coordinate. And then the radius of the spheres is a function on this two-dimensional space, and n is the derivative. And this is the system of equations which you get as Bogomolny equations in addition to this equation for n. And in fact, turns out, again, introducing this kind of rescale radial variable, you can express everything in terms of the BPS monopole. So the Higgs field is in a way made up from this, from the dilaton and the radial function, and there is no Higgs field. So this is, I don't understand why this works, but maybe sometime somebody will find a connection to the other embedding of the BPS monopole. At the moment, this is a kind of miracle that this works. And this solution, in fact, the metric which you get is not asymptotically flat and not anti-de-Sitter. I mean, it has some singularity at infinity.
It has an actual singularity.
Yes, yes. The dilaton grows like a log. So it does not go to constant. So that's, however, this is still not our solution. It's still a monopole. W is the monopole field which goes to zero. And so then when I saw this, I called up Forkov and said, listen, you are taking, you have this dilaton potential, but you have these two parameters, which these two gauge couplings, G1 and G2. Why not taking G1 equal to I G2? Then this cancels. And then it could be that you get new type of Bogomolny equations which have a chance to be the ones for our solution, which is clearly a solution without the dilaton potential. We have no dilaton potential in our action, which is...
But if G squared is negative, that usually gives sort of instability.
Yeah, and this is not good with supersymmetry, you're saying. Right? This is what you have in mind in Bogomolny and so on. I will tell you why this doesn't matter. It turned out that, in fact, there is a group theoretical interpretation again to this procedure. Namely, you again start off with the 10-dimensional n=1 theory, just supergravity, no Young-Mills field. And you reduce it to 4-dimensional Euclidean theory. So you take a 4-dimensional Euclidean gauged SU2 cross SU11 gauge theory. And in order to get the signatures right, you see, because in 10 dimensions, in order to have this n=1 theory in 10 dimensions, you have to have signature 9 minus and 1 plus. Otherwise, you don't have Majorana Weyl spinors. So now this you can achieve by taking the killing metric for SU2, which has all minus signs, and the negative of the killing metric of SU11, because SU11 has 2 plus and 1 minus sign in the killing metric, because it has 2 non-compact generators and 1 compact. So, and then you see you remain with 4 negative signs in 4 dimensions, which gives you a 4-dimensional Euclidean theory. Now, formally, this corresponds to putting G1 equal to 1 and G2 equal to I. But group theoretically, it means just this. And then you go again through the whole business, make the spherical-symmetric ansatz and so on, and try to derive the Killing-Spinor equation and see what you get. Now, this theory actually has a Minkowski vacuum, because there is no potential, so this is perfect with asymptotically flat solutions. In fact, our solution is asymptotically flat, so it better has the Minkowski vacuum as a solution. Now, if you do all this, and it's again quite a lot of work, then you end up with Spogomolny equations, which I have written down here. Again, there is this function n, which is related to the derivative of this radial function r, which is not used as a radial coordinate. I use some independent coordinate psi. And, you get a rather complicated system of equations. So one algebraic equation and two first-order equations. And miraculously, our solution solved this.
I thought your solutions were four-dimensional Lorentzian.
Yes, but they are time-independent.
So you analytically continue that.
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, you embed them, so to say, in this Euclidean theory where nothing depends on x4. So from the three-dimensional solution, you don't see if this is a solution of a Euclidean theory or a Minkowski, like the BPS monopole. You can interpret it as an x4-independent solution of the Euclidean Yang-Mills theory, you see. This is quite analogous. Clearly, I mean, I do not advocate this four-dimensional theory, gauge theory, as a thing you should use to describe nature. I mean, this is has no positive. Well, it's Euclidean anyway, and then it has wrong signs in the action and so on, and because the internal manifold is non-compact, and but anyway, the purpose was to get the solution.
And if you just take the four-dimensional theory and analytically continue back, you say you ruin the supersymmetry.
Yeah.
You don't see the
Yeah. This is the whole point there. You need this signature in 10 dimensions. Actually, this is also is a new gauged supergravity in four dimensions. I mean, with a vanishing dilaton potential. This was not known before. So. And it was very courageous fork of to work out the whole embedding of this into the 10-dimensional series. So he checked that it really solves the 10-dimensional field equation, which is quite a lot of computation. And now, to come to the end of our story, our solution really solved this amazingly. And, in fact, if you look at these equations, they are horrible. I mean, they're very complicated. And these are nonlinear system of nonlinear first order equations, which we were out for the exact solution, so we were rather desperate. But then we found a first integral. So this combination is just equal to this coordinate psi. So this is very encouraging. And then if you use this, you can reduce everything to this equation. So there is only one first order nonlinear equation, is so called Abel's equation of the second type, which means that the right hand side is a cubic polynomial in the dependent variable. Now, unfortunately, the coefficients depend in a, well, not very complicated, but nevertheless, they depend on the independent variable. And so there is no guarantee that you can solve this. And we tried everything, I mean, even looking up in Kamke, and we couldn't solve it. So, but what you can do is you can write down the Taylor series expansion with the origin at infinity and so on, and you find that at the origin, in fact, all the coefficients are determined by the equations up to the fifth. The fifth is an arbitrary coefficient for this equation due to its singular nature at psi equals zero, and this has to be determined numerically and comes out something like minus 30 or so. But the 1/6 is already here. So this gives the 1/6. So this is already a part of the equation. And the other regularities we've observed are also part of the equation. So this is the only numerically determined coefficient. Now, there is a simple exact solution of this complicated equation, which is this rational function. And in fact, it has the property that it goes from plus 1 to minus 1. But it's the wrong one, because it has a pole, polarity, and anyway, so it's singular, it's not what we want. So, that's the long story of this particular solution, which we still don't have in closed form. But at least we found a new supergravity model, and we found Bogomol equations. So, this is the summary. You can embed this particular solution, actually only this one, not the one, there is a solution with two zeros and three zeros and so on of W. These are not, cannot be embedded. It's only this n equal 1 solution you can embed. Now, and in fact, these coefficients P for the other ones are rather weird. But there is a particular solution. This is the one with infinitely many zeros, which looks regular again. And this may be, can also be embedded into some supergravity, which you don't know. But anyway, that is the end of this story. I hope it's not yet the end and somebody will solve this bloody equation.
I didn't quite understand. You said that when you said that your solution embeds into this, I thought that what you meant was that the equations that your solutions satisfied became, you know, were part of the equation for this solution, or ensured that these.
Well, you make an ansatz. I mean, it's not only the solution. You see, you make an ansatz for this for the 10-dimensional theory in terms of these 4-dimensional fields. And any solution of the 4-dimensional field equations which we write down solves the 10-dimensional ones. So it's not only this particular solution, it's the whole class of this ansatz. But this is not the most general ansatz. I mean, it is not that we can write down, so to say, an effective 4-dimensional theory for all 10-dimensional solutions which have this SU2 cross SU2 or SU2 cross SU11 isometric group.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, I mean, I was puzzled by the statement that only the sort of n equals 1 solution embedded in the higher end solutions didn't.
Solves, only the n equals 1 solution solves the Bogomol equation.
Oh, it solves the Bogomol equation.
Yeah, it solves the second order field equations, but it does not solve the Bogomol equation. There is only one solution. And the only one solution is determined, the only one regular is determined by this coefficient C. You have to fine-tune this coefficient C to get a globally regular solution of this Bogomol equation. And so there cannot be any other. I mean, there could be maybe solutions which are superpositions, which are not spherically symmetric like for the monopoles, but that we don't know. That would be very complicated, I mean, to get those. From the form of the solution, there is no difference. Look here. I forgot to show you this nice picture, this nice graph. So this is the numerically determined solution, and this is the W goes from plus 1 to minus 1, and this is the dilaton normalized to 0 at the origin, which has a nice asymptotic value. And it just looks like the Bartnik-McKinnon. Mm-hmm. It's only that it solves other equations, because there is an addition to this dilaton.
But also, I mean, if you look at the other solutions,
they look more or less the same, yes.
And what about this limiting solution? I mean, this exists everywhere, and it's regular everywhere.
Yeah, the limiting solution is the following thing. This is actually a quite interesting phenomenon. You find that if you look at solutions which have more and more zeros, that the zeros accumulate at, if you use Schwarzschild coordinates, at r equal 1. So, So if you look at these solutions, they look like that. They start oscillating here, there's r equal 1, and then they do something like that, and eventually get to plus minus. So this is a solution which this number n much larger than 1. And this is Schwarzschild R, and this is R equal 1 in suitable units, which is Planck units. And then, I mean, this is a solution, a regular solution with many zeros, and it goes to plus or minus 1 at infinity. And you ask, what happens if n goes to infinity? So is there a solution with infinitely many zeros? In fact, there is, and it ends here at r equal 1, and outside is, so to say, identically zero. Now, identically zero means it's extreme rational Nordström here, and it is something non-trivial in here. So this in here, now extremal Reisner Nordström is an extremal black hole. But this interior is clearly not what is the analytic continuation of this, because this would be identically zero again. And so this is a kind of, and in fact if you ask, it is smooth everywhere, and you ask, what is this point? In fact, it turns out the geodesic distance of this point from the origin is infinite. So this actually is an infinite cylinder type of thing. So it looks like that. There is the origin, and then the radius here goes to 1, asymptotically. So actually, it is like the outside. You see, we are always on the T equal constant hypersurface. So if you look at the extreme horizon of Nordström, you go to this to this infinitely far point which corresponds to the bifurcation surface for non-degenerate black holes, so which is this throat, infinite throat of Reisner-Nordström. But the two so the solution with many zeros looks like that. Asymptotically, then it widens up, the spheres widen up, go to infinity, and when n goes to infinity, this becomes infinitely long, and the solution up to here, so to say, becomes geodesically complete. That is a kind of static cosmological solution of a static cosmos field with a Young-Mills field. And asymptotically, it becomes ADS. So because the Young-Mills field strength goes to a finite value at this throat here. So it is and the two solutions are disconnected. In fact, the G0 component blows up in either direction. So if you normalize it here, it blows up out here. Then if you want to connect it to the extreme horizon Nordström, you have to do an infinite rescaling.
It's becoming
asymptotic
to
ADS in this two-dimensional section. So it's a product of a two-sphere times this Bertotti whatever metric. Yeah, ADS2. And, well, a similar phenomenon you have with the dilaton. Also with the dilaton, this is very similar, but this point moves out there.
I mean, one can't say, the dilaton does systematically this and this and this to the Bartnik-McKinnon solution also, and it's just similar.
It's similar. Now, if you look at this corresponding solution along here it turns out that the dilaton e to the phi grows like r for this limiting solution with infinitely many zeros. Actually, this coefficient b is equal to 1/4 for the solution with infinitely many zeros, again by numerics. So this is why I said that maybe there is also something here. And I wanted to say one remark to this phenomenon.
Namely, have no feeling for these numbers 1/4, 1/6. Or
you have no feeling for 1/4.
Why do you assume that there's something exact if it's 1/4 and not 1/2.56? I don't know. I mean, why is it one more exact?
Well, God has given us the natural numbers, and he must have had something in mind by doing that. Now, I wanted to make a remark about this limiting solution. You find also, if you take self-gravitating magnetic monopoles and you make the monopole heavier and heavier, that there is a limiting solution which has this kind of throat. And if you take these disks of dust, which are studied by Neugebauer and company, and you make the central density of this, I mean, they study rotating disks of dust. And if you make the central density bigger and bigger, then again, they develop a throat, and the outside limiting solution is the extremal curve. So this is a rather general phenomenon. If you make gravity stronger and stronger in a sequence, in a family of static solutions, that there is a critical value for the mass or the energy density, whatever, and the limiting solution has this throat. And so to say, the outer part becomes an extremal black hole, and the inner thing decouples itself and is a closed, geodesically complete solution by itself. This is also true for this dust solution of Neugebauer and Meinl. So it's a new phenomenon for these kind of solutions.
Okay.